Welcome to Open Line. I'm Mike Thompson, sitting in for Fred Anderle today. 40 years ago, this was the American dream. You went to work every day. You stayed with the same company for decades. You had your 2 or 3 weeks of vacation a year. You went from driving a Chevy to maybe an Olds or to a Buick. And you retired at the age of 65, and maybe you could afford a Cadillac. All during your career, your company contributed to a pension plan, which usually included health benefits. The company you worked for took care of you. You got a pension check and health insurance upon retirement, but a strange thing happened on the way to that retirement bliss. Retirees lived longer. Health care costs skyrocketed. Companies did not keep up with contributions, and foreign competition cut into revenues. If the days of secure pensions are not over, they are certainly numbered. To talk about this looming crisis is Roger Lowenstein, the best-selling author and former Wall Street Journal reporter. His new book is called While America Aged, How Pension Debts Ruined General Motors, Stopped the New York City Subways, Bankrupted San Diego, and How They Loom as the Next Financial Crisis. Roger Lowenstein, welcome to Open Line.
Mike, it's a pleasure to be on the show.
We will take your phone calls at 292-8513, 292-8513, or you can email your questions at openline@wosu.org. Roger, the cover of your book shows a man in a dark business suit. Presumably he's an executive, maybe he's a politician. He's kneeling on a beach, a shovel at his side, but his head is stuck in a hole in the sand. I take it he's not digging for clams.
No, you know, he could be an exec or a politician, could be a union leader, could be a voter. Mm-hmm. The, you know, Mike, some of these crises we've had, like Enron, even the Fannie Mae, the mortgage crisis, seem to sneak up on us out of nowhere. This has been very different. We've been hearing that the country's demographics have been changing, that we face a looming crisis with more people retiring and fewer people working to support them, and with not enough money being put aside, the country not saving enough money to support them. And the stories in this book, you know, I think they're all fun, interesting tales about different characters and institutions that ran into trouble, but they're all variations of this theme that, you know, when the demographics change and when you promise a good life to people retiring, you better provide for it. Mm-hmm. And we didn't do it. That's, you know, that's the guy with his head in the sand. He's, you know, he didn't do it. He had his head in the sand, so... That's the cover.
What's the current situation? You know, who's covered by pensions now? The folks who did retire 10, 20 years ago, they have decent pensions still?
The current situation, you have to break it down. Mm-hmm. When people talk about the pension system in this country, there really is no one system.
Yeah.
We don't have a national pension, which is, you know, we can get into one of the dreams of Walter Reuther, the United Auto Workers, was mm-hmm. Was that there should be a federal responsibility and one system. But what we have, of course, is a system of or a group, a collection of companies that agreed, sometimes voluntarily, sometimes because the unions forced them years ago, to give pensions to their workers. And these were the gold-plated pensions, great deals for the workers. The guy you described, he worked his way up the line and, you know, started with that Chevy and moved mm-hmm. up to the, you know, Oldsmobile and the Pontiac and maybe someday the Cadillac, and he could retire for life. And as long as he lived and after his spouse and dependents kept that pension. And that used to cover 60% of the private sector workforce. And, you know, one of the real crises is because of what happened to, say, General Motors, one of the examples, you know, documented in detail in the book, airline companies, other companies, that steel companies that gave pensions, so many of them have gone through Chapter 11 and just been destroyed by it. Companies are giving up their pension programs. And, you know, this is one of the, you know, this is the way in which the problem really hits the average worker and the average working family hardest. Today, only 18% of people Wow. in the private sector workforce have pensions. So one of the sad parts of this history is the private system is withering, and as we know it, or as we knew it, that traditional pension in the private sector is probably gone, and we're going to have to come up with something else because companies aren't replacing the new companies that are coming along. You know, all of Silicon Valley, for one,
yeah.
Don't have them, and you see now even auto companies and companies in the manufacturing belt, as they restructure, they're restructuring without traditional pensions. After that, you know, another part of our system is that we have 401ks, and those aren't really a system. Those are just the government has said, look, the companies and workers, if you want to put money aside for your retirement, you know, terrific, you won't tax it. Well, that's great, but the median family in this country has only $31,000 in their 401k, and that's not, you know, every year. That's for life. You know, try retiring on $31,000. How many times can you get to the service station back on $31,000?
Yeah, it's really just a saving mechanism. The burden is still on the employee to take care of him or herself.
The last part of the pension system, and the part that's been growing in terms of numbers, is the public pension system. And that's cities and towns and states and university systems that have pensions. And there, because the strength of labor unions in the public sector really began to grow at the same time that private sector workforces lost their collective clout. You think of, you know, the troubles of the UAW, the steel workers, over the last 20, 30, even 40 years. It's over that time that teachers, hospital workers, cops, firemen, so on, have gained clout. Mm-hmm. Their pensions are very rich, and the problem is different. The problem there is that legislators face the tough choice of, do they award rich and growing pensions to their workers, or face political pressure if they didn't, and if they do, do they tax the taxpayers to pay for them? And they decided, well, why don't we just award the pensions and not tax either and not fund them?
Yeah, put it off for the next guy.
Yeah, and now we face a deficit of something like $1 trillion on these public plans. And for a while, for several years, this was all masked by growing real estate revenues. Most states are indirect investors or stakeholders in the real estate system, because when you take out a mortgage, you pay a mortgage recording tax, and you pay a tax on the gain of sale of a house and so on. Mm-hmm. But, you know, that, well, we know what's happened to, you know, that.
Yeah.
You know, that one's over for a long time. So states are now, once again, under severe budget pressure, and their pension obligations are really over the top. And mm-hmm. In the last part of this so-called system is Social Security, which, you know, has been controversial, I guess, for a long time, and President Bush made it controversial again when he tried to in part privatize it. And one of the things I say in the book is it was a private pension system in tatters. We should be strengthening Social Security, not diminishing it, but at the same time not let Social Security fall into the same trap of being underfunded and put it off to the next generation. So that's a thumbnail sketch, and it, you know, it hits different sectors of the society in different ways. And if I can give listeners a thumbnail way to think about the whole problem, it's that we got more folks retiring, and we're going to have to, we're all of us as a society going to have to save more, just as you would if you were a family, and some of your, say your grandparents were going to retire, you'd say, well, look, you know, they're still going to be eating at the table. They're not going to be bringing home a salary, so we got to start putting something aside for them. Mm-hmm. So why has America as a society been not saving? We've been consuming more than we're earning, and that's just nuts.
We're speaking with Roger Lowenstein. He's a former Wall Street Journal reporter and author of the book While America Aged. It really chronicles the problems we face with our pension system, using the term system as a mixture of public and private pension systems across the country. It is simple math. The aging population, the over 65 population, is going to double in the next 20 years.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. And you know, you only have to look at companies like General Motors, where this is accentuated by the decline in the workforce, so that in recent years they've been taking care of something like 1 million workers and dependents have been receiving GM pensions and health care, supported by a base mm-hmm. of, first it was a few hundred thousand, then 100,000. Now they're down to something like, the numbers change so fast because of the layoffs, but something like 75,000. Blue-collar workers, and when you attempt to support 1 million graybeards with 75,000 working people, it's an unsustainable model. I don't care if you're a Republican or a Democrat, a conservative or a liberal, that math doesn't work. And in fact, GM, one of the last points in the book, the end of that episode, they finally give up and they say to the United Auto Workers, we can't pay for your health care anymore. And the whole thing has been foisted back on the UAW, which doesn't really solve the problem because the UAW has declining membership. And whether they'll have the money to cover the health care for their retired members, is really an open question.
So we're speaking with Roger Lowenstein, author of the book While America Aged, talking about the pension debts and the pension system in the United States. So what happened back in the booming days of American manufacturing in the days following World War II? I mean, were companies too generous? I mean, were the unions too greedy? What happened?
Well, they were, both of those, in a sense, is true. Although, it's a union's job to be greedy, right? It's
looking
your job
for
to be greedy and get the top salary that an interviewer can get, and my job to get the best advance I can get on a book. So it's, where does the restraint come from? It's really the executive's job to put the brake on and say, this much we can afford and this much we can't. And really, what they were was too short-sighted. The trap with pensions, whether it's a public or private system, and it is a trap, is that the expense is in the future.
Mm-hmm.
So it's very tempting to approve a pension or to approve a pension increase if it will avoid short-term pain, because the pain that it incurs is only in the future. And, we're all of us that way. We'd all rather face pain tomorrow than today or the day after tomorrow.
That's right.
So one generation after another of auto executives and steel executives, airline executives, but sticking with auto executives, said, I'm going to get rid of that cell phone, I apologize.
That's all right. Said,
we don't want to strike. Let's give the union what they want or most of what they want and keep the factories humming. And that system, Zach, could you turn that phone off? Thanks.
Speaking with Roger Lowenstein, the author of While America Aged.
This interview is in the 21st century. Cell phones go off. So, and that system worked okay during the, year remembered as the golden years for American manufacturing, because it was all American. There was just really GM, mm-hmm. Chrysler, and Ford. Whatever pensions one approved, the others did.
So the short-term pain was, instead of paying higher salaries over the next 5 years or 7 years of a contract, or whatever it might be, the long-term
pain. There was no pain because the cost could just be passed on to the consumer.
Yeah, but
because they had no choice. And when you went into the showroom to buy the Chevy, you got the pension along with the tail fins, whether you knew it or not. What changed was, by the late 60s, there was a serious competition from imports, particularly Japanese, from manufacturers that weren't paying these pensions and didn't have these health care costs. And then suddenly, the consumer had a choice. He could get the Chevy with a pension or the Datsun or the Toyota, whatever, without it. It was cheaper and better made. And while American car companies were pouring their money into benefits, Japanese were pouring their money into research. And from that point on, as an economic model, the benefits of the car companies became unsustainable. And at that point, the auto companies really had 20 or 30 years to readjust, and they kept deferring. And believe it or not, the benefits kept getting richer and richer throughout the 60s, the 70s, the 80s. Finally, in the 90s, they began to try to put a brake on it, and by then it was too late. In the 90s, the amount of money that GM put into its pension fund was enough so that had they not had that burden, they could have bought half of the Toyota Corp.
Were the companies contributing enough into these plans all along?
Very often not. That was part of the game, that they made promises and they fell terribly behind. And there was a law passed. The reason we have an ERISA law, the law is called ERISA, that governs pensions, is because of a famous collapse of an auto company, the Studebaker Company, which in an effort to placate, older listeners may remember the Lark, was a very popular boxy car back in the late 50s and early 60s. Studebaker was one of those early auto companies that survived past World War II, and then in an effort to keep its workers from going on strike, approved, believe it or not, four pension increases in the mid and late 1950s. In 1962, they failed, and workers lost. Workers who had had the so-called promise of pensions found out there was nothing there for them. And after it took 10 years for the Congress to thrash it out, but they passed the ERISA law, and it did a number of things. It said you couldn't stop union officials from squandering the money like Jimmy Hoffa and so on, the Teamsters, and set rules to make sure that the investments of pension funds were diversified. And it also said, look, to companies, you have to keep a pension funded. The trouble was that companies kept finding ways to get around it. It's not a simple matter when you say keep it fully funded. What does fully funded mean? Mm-hmm. Well, that means that there should be enough money now so that by the time the worker reaches retirement age, the money will grow to enough. Well, you have to know when the worker's going to retire. Mm-hmm. You have to know how long he's going to live. You have to know how fast the money in the fund's going to grow.
That's where the 1990s came in.
That's right.
When the stock market boomed in the 90s.
General Motors kept its pension fund, quote, fully funded, unquote, by making very aggressive assumptions. For many years, they were at 11%. About how fast their fund would grow each year. And, you know, anyone following markets today knows just how aggressive 11% is, I think. And then that's 11% is an average of stocks and bonds. It's been a long time since, any of us have seen 11% in virtually any market. And so General Motors fell woefully behind in the 90s, and you know, at the time when the Japanese were putting money into hybrids, improving the dashboard, computerization, safety records, reliability, General Motors is running a retirement home mm-hmm. with its retirement health care service, you know, that used to be known as an HMO on wheels. And it never really, none of the American companies really recovered from that.
We're speaking with Roger Lowenstein. He's a former Wall Street Journal reporter, best-selling author. His latest book is While America Aged, How Pension Debts Have Ruined General Motors, Stopped the New York City Subways, Bankrupted San Diego, and they loom as the next financial crisis.
Just add one thing, Mike.
Is sure. That,
because we're harping on the GM example for a moment, but I'm in no way opposed to benefits. Mm-hmm. And Walter Reuther's point, you know, very early on was he said to the companies, Reuther was a fascinating guy who traveled all around the world in the Depression, visiting mills and factories to bring back, he hoped, the best of what he saw in terms of social organizations to America. And one thing he saw was the benefits in other countries, and by the way, he worked for 2 years in the Soviet Union in the 30s at a plant, was that benefits were socialized.
Mm-hmm.
And he said to GM, you guys don't want this burden, and it shouldn't just go to auto workers, it should go to everybody. Come down with me to Washington. Let's work together for benefits. And the executives of that period, late 40s and 50s, wanted no part of anything that was socialistic, and they said no. And as the UAW officials, somewhat astonished, said to themselves, the auto companies don't seem to realize that if they don't help us get these benefits from government, they themselves, the only ones left to provide it, will win it. We'll demand it. We'll win it over the collective bargaining table. And the wisdom of what Reuther said is coming home to roost. You can see it now. There's almost no one now who opposes, for instance, a national role in health care.
Let's go to the phones.
Yeah.
Bob has been waiting patiently. Go ahead, Bob. You're on the air.
Hey, thanks for taking my call. I'm a little confused about where the conversation is going, and it's like I'm trying to feel whether you're for pensions or against pensions, but I did want to clarify one thing. There are two types of pensions. There's one that's called a defined benefit, which the guest is talking about. Now, those are the ones that can bankrupt a corporation because the risk of the pension is put upon the corporation. And as you point out, that these corporations can't be socialist states. Sooner or later, the unions can coerce them into making some pretty bad decisions and they go bankrupt. And that's what's been going on. But what you've seen in the trend in the industry is that people, the firms aren't going to go bankrupt or bust on these things. What they do is they roll them over into what's called a defined contribution plan. And when you have a defined contribution plan, the risk is on the employee mm-hmm. to select the correct options.
Let me pick up on that because and I don't know if you got to hear the last bit while you were holding, but I'll just repeat. I'm not against benefits, and there's a consistent message in the book, which is that benefits have to be funded. What I'm against is promised benefits that aren't funded. And when you point out that there's this relatively newer type of pension, the defined contribution, which we refer to more colloquially as a 401k, those are great. The trouble with 401ks is there's no guarantee any money's going to go into them. And for many Americans, I noted that figure earlier in the show, the median figure for the American family in a 401k is $31,000. So, we can talk about some of the proposals to get that number up, but 401ks are a lot safer for the institutions, but they haven't filled the gap for the workers.
Well, there are things such as target retirement funds where they have professional management design those portfolios for the retirement age. One way to overfund those things would simply be to privatize Social Security and take your 12.4% and send it into a 401k, which has your name on it. But as far as the underfunding of the pensions that you're talking about, I'm looking at a headline right now on pensions and investments article, and it says surplus hits $111 billion. The Pensions Investment Review shows top 100 corporations' plans remain overfunded. And I was kind of curious, what are you speaking mostly of the manufacturing and unionized industries, or are you talking as the pension industry as a whole for the entire U.S.? Because it looks like the U.S. pensions are actually in good shape, but the union ones, the ones that are having to fight with the unions, are in actually bad shape.
There is no as a whole. Some companies are overfunded, but many are underfunded, and it doesn't do Ford any good, which is underfunded, to know that, say, General Electric is overfunded. There's no averaging out. There's no socialization of the guarantee. So those numbers are a bit misleading. And by the way, they'll dramatically change with what's happened to the stock market recently. I can guarantee you that the next set of numbers won't look so rosy. Thanks for the call. But the private pension system is actually disappearing. Mm-hmm. The numbers of private sector workers who were covered down to now 18%. So in many cases, for instance, IBM is fully funded. Now, that's one of the companies that goes in your average. That's great, but it's frozen its plan. No workers at IBM are accruing new benefits, so there's no risk at IBM, no increase in the risk, but they're actually running out the string at IBM, as they are at Hewlett Packard, as they are at dozens of other companies that are frozen, and frozen means they've refused to accrue future benefits, and as the workers who are already promised pensions retire and eventually pass away, those pension systems will and are disappearing.
So it's basically the older workers who have been at IBM for quite some time, they have a defined benefit pension, but the newer workers are on 401ks and that kind of thing.
Yeah. I want to pick up on something else the caller mentioned, which was the idea of privatizing Social Security. And he also mentioned 401ks, which are individual plans. There is a great natural economic advantage to collective pension systems if they're fully funded, and this is the reason is that what a pension system does is it takes an average of how long they're expected to live. Some people are going to live into their 90s, some aren't, and although the people who live into their 90s cost it a lot more money, it in effect subsidizes their pensions by the money saved on people who die in their 50s.
Mm-hmm.
Similarly, some people will retire when the market's high, some when the market's low. And again, it can subsidize the people who are unlucky enough to have retired when their investments are low by selling securities, the securities it sells for those who retire when stocks are high. If you're on your own system, let's say you're just your own 401k, the averages don't do you any good. You can't save for the average life expectancy. You might live to 90.
Yeah.
And the fact that the average American lives to 82, whatever it is now, doesn't do you any good. So the each individual person, if we're saving on our own, either has to oversave or faces the risks of running out. We lose the insurance benefit when we get away from collective systems, which is one reason I'm opposed to individualizing Social Security.
We have to take a break here. We're speaking with Roger Lowenstein. He's the author of While America Aged. It chronicles three stories of how pension debts have ruined three different organizations and how it is our next looming financial crisis. We'll continue our discussion with Roger Lowenstein when Open Line continues on WOSU 820 NPR News.
Can't believe everything you see. That recent photo of the launch of four Iranian missiles? It was a fake. Remember O.J. Simpson's menacing face on the cover of Time? That was doctored, too.
It's a gross violation of the implied covenant that the press has with the public.
I'm Neil Conan. Photography's lost innocence, what's real, what's not, and why it matters. Next Talk of the Nation from NPR News.
Talk of the Nation begins later this afternoon. It's here from 2 until 4, right here on WOSU 820, NPR News. And good morning, I'm Amy Jurevich. It is 68 degrees at 10:32. Thanks for joining us for Open Line this morning. The switch to digital TV is coming. You can help older adults with the switch by donating your unneeded converter box coupons to WOSU. Visit wosu.org/DTV to apply for your coupons today. Or call 292-9678 for more information. Set your morning alarm to Morning Edition, now on WOSU 89.7 FM from 5 to 9 a.m. and start your day with the latest news. In the weather forecast for today, becoming sunny later in the afternoon, a high around 78.
Support for WOSU comes from the Columbus Metropolitan Club, where you can be part of a live discussion at weekly luncheons. More information is available at www.columbusmetroclub.org.
Welcome back to Open Line. I'm Mike Thompson, sitting in for Fred Anderle. We're discussing the pension systems of the United States, both public and private, with Roger Lowenstein, the former Wall Street Journal reporter, best-selling author. His latest book is called While America Aged, How the Pension Systems Loom as Our Next Financial Crisis. Let's go to the phones, and Jerry has been waiting very patiently. Go ahead, Jerry.
Thank you, Mike. You're doing a top-of-the-fence job.
Thank you.
Mr. Lowenstein, I have been in my 18th year of drawing Social Security, and Ida Mae Fuller, the first woman who drew it, got
right.
First person got $22 a month, but Ida Mae lived to be 100.
Yeah.
Now, GM.
I hope you're getting more than 20 bucks.
Thank goodness. But it was supposed to be, as FDR said, a three-legged stool: personal savings, Social Security,
right.
And private pension, if it came. Now, I have no objection to GM doing away with the pensions, but are they doing away for the pensions for officers of the company? Roger Smith, until he passed away, was getting $100,000. Not a year, a month.
It's a very good question. GM recently cut out medical benefits for retired salary for managers. People have already been promised a pension. You can't, workers or managers, by law, it can't be revoked. But the auto company executives, the benefits have gotten less generous. I think if you look around other companies, the very good point the caller has, these executives are getting tens of millions put in their special pension program, and it's kind of a scandal, actually a scandal. This is an outrage, and the fact that GM can't sustain these kind of benefits for their workers in no way, in my mind, lets the executives off the hook. And Roger Smith, who the caller points out, terribly abused the system at a time when GM was, or at least he believed, it was a still a rich company. The recent generation of auto executives, have not been abusive, in my opinion. Although Miller, the guy who took over at Delphi, the former GM parts company that went bankrupt, he did take a $3 million bonus. He made a lot of noise by saying, "Well, I'm not going to take a salary and everything," but he did take $3 million before he put the company into bankruptcy, and then laid off an awful lot of people and cut salaries and cut benefits and the works. So, do I think the executive compensation system is that also out of whack? You betcha.
Thank you.
You're not going to find me defending that one. In fact, I've written more about that than my career than pensions.
Yeah. Could I say, Mike, I just saw the Death of the Electric Car, two-hour documentary.
Uh-huh.
GM created the EV1. Impact, GM destroyed it. They would not let anyone purchase it. They could only lease it, so they had the right to recall them. And I have the book by Brock Yates, senior editor of a Car and Driver magazine, The Decline and Fall of the American Auto Industry. That was published, gentlemen, in 1983, mm-hmm. 25 years ago. Mm-hmm. So this is nothing. This shouldn't be surprising to anybody who's kept their eye on the ball, but you had a hypothetical caller even last year calling in, and must have been a Larry Kudlow addict. Kudlow and Company is a Goldilocks economy. Oh yeah, have a good day, gentlemen.
All right, thanks
for the time. Call.
Yeah, it's not just pension debts that helped ruin GM. I mean, I remember back in high school driving a Chevette, and let's just say that was not the ideal American automobile. I mean, these companies, rested on their laurels, and then the Japanese automakers came in. Was it just pensions?
Absolutely not. But yeah. And I go into that in the book. But I'll make one distinction, which is that virtually all of the other ailments that these companies ran into, they could have, if they had the wisdom, the understanding, and the will, they could correct them. Mm-hmm. The thing about pension debts is, you get these obligations. You can't get rid of them. They're there. So it's for workers, they're the gift that keeps giving. But for the institutions, they're the obligation that won't go away. So of course it's not just that. But it's not an accident that all these industries, steel, airlines, autos, where you saw these tremendous benefits, they eventually went under because. It's the one mistake you couldn't get rid of, and that's what distinguishes the pension.
Okay, 292-8513, 292-8513. If you'd like to speak with Roger Lowenstein, author of the book While America Aged, How the Pension Debts Are Looming as Our Next Financial Crisis. David, you're on the air.
Good morning. Thank you, gentlemen, for this very relevant program. I had a comment Mr. Lowenstein mentioned some time back in his discussion that in the 1960s, Japan, automakers were able to export things here, and when we purchased them, we weren't funding pension systems and things like we were if we bought a General Motors car. Actually, the Japanese have a very progressive European-style pension system, and it does cover auto workers, and they get 20 days of vacation a year.
It's government.
Yeah, who's paying the bill?
Well, the auto the employee pays in just as we do, and the manufacturer pays in to a pension program. And they
but
had
the,
that after
1929. The government takes up a lot of that, and it takes up all their health care.
Yes, it does. Yeah. Well, actually, in Japan, the automakers pay 80% of the health care premium.
Well, the difference, according to GM, was there the health care is $1,500 a car, what they pay and the Japanese pay.
And the Japanese have always calculated fringe benefits, vacation, health care, and pension programs into the cost of manufacturing and selling their cars also.
Well, the $1,500 is the difference between what the manufacturers paid. Is the difference between what an American and a Japanese manufacturer would have paid. That's a pretty big difference.
Okay.
Yes, it is. But I think the difference is the social safety net in many countries is structured in such a way that it's not such a burden on the manufacturers as it is in the United States.
That's my whole point. I'm all for it.
Okay.
Thank you, David.
Thanks.
292-8513, 292-8513, if you'd like to join in our discussion. The Pension Benefit Guarantee Corporation, that's the government-backed corporation that takes over these pensions if a company goes under.
Correct.
Is that an answer? I'd assume not, long term.
Well, you know, an insurance system is, you know, ultimately it's backed by the U.S. government.
Mm-hmm.
The idea of the PBGC is that the strong pension, that every pension sponsor would put money into the pool, and you know, when one company went under, the PBGC would fund it out of the premiums of those who are still around. The problem is that as companies have frozen their systems, particularly strong companies, the PBGC has become increasingly become an association just of weak companies. And when you know, let's say a new company, a Google, say, looks at do they want to establish a pension, there are lots of reasons today why Google wouldn't. But one reason is, you know, why would Google want to establish a pension, which would mean it would have to get into a pool with companies like Chrysler and Ford and American Airlines? You know, and so there's a self-selection by which the PBGC is increasingly a collection of companies that are weak and under strain from pension costs. But you know, so ultimately, an insurance system is only as strong as the members of the pool.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it itself now has a deficit of. It was $19 billion when the book went to press, a few billion less in the latest figure, and it'll be more in the next figure due to what's happened in the stock market. But it's itself underwater.
Yeah.
But the insurance system can't be any stronger than the system itself or than the sponsors themselves.
Do the defined benefit pensions, the, you know, like the old pension system,
yeah.
I mean, with the transient nature of today's workforce – I mean, you can see why Google doesn't have a pension system.
I can.
Those folks may only stay there 3 or 5 years, if that, you know.
Look, if somebody said today your employer should fund your kids' schools, mm-hmm. okay, you'd say that doesn't make sense. I could move.
Yeah.
I won't be in the same town as my employer. And the only reason why health care and pensions grew up with you know, our employer funded still in many cases is because of the legacy of when people would go to work and stay there, you know, throughout most or you know, very often all their careers. In the public sector, things are a little different.
Mm-hmm.
It's still Google doesn't want the pension. When private pensions were created, companies wanted that. They wanted to give you an incentive to stay 20, 30, 40 years.
Yeah.
Google doesn't want that. They don't want the commitment. But in the public sector, it's different. School boards, school systems, fire departments, police departments, they still have an interest in having workers who, you know, who stay 20, 30, 40 years. And the workers themselves, many of them, that's still the implicit bargain that you know, you can't get fired. You got a job. So there, I think the basic premise of the pension system still has merit, and that's why the numbers are not slipping in the pension system. And some states, for financial reasons, the reason I talk about, are trying to get out of defined benefits, but not many of them have.
We're speaking with Roger Lowenstein, former Wall Street Journal reporter, best-selling author. His latest book is While America Aged, How Our Pension Debts are Looming as Our Next Financial Crisis. Spend the last 15 minutes of the program talking about, okay, now what? What are the solutions to this? We've touched on it briefly. The government could step in, and that's what you know, union leaders wanted back in the day when this whole thing started.
Yeah. Well, we got to break this down, okay? Let's talk about the state systems, which are hundreds of billions, probably $1 trillion underfunded, and if you include the health care promises that they've made to their retirees, you know, well over that amount. What we really need for the states is we need a law like ERISA. ERISA tells companies how much they have to put in. Now, the companies don't always do it. They play games with the calculations, as we discussed, but they can't just say no. In Illinois, they've just, you know, they basically ignored the obligation. There's something like 50% underfunded. In West Virginia, they're woefully underfunded. In New Jersey, where I'm speaking from, Governor Corzine is trying to sell off the New Jersey Turnpike because he can't raise any money otherwise, and the pension is $30 billion underfunded. California, terrible problems. One of the chapters in the book is about how San Diego tried to run the city government off of money that should have been going into the pension fund.
Mm-hmm.
The mayors resigned, people are out and died out there, and so on. We can't have this game of promising public workers who have this political clout great pensions, and they're not funding them. And there need to be laws that mandate that if you promise a pension, and in my opinion, retiree health care, you have to fund it. And that's the beginning of sanity in the public sector. And in the meantime, you know, we're going to see higher taxes and/or service cuts in many state governments. I know Ohio's funding is, you know, very tight right now, and you know, that's a given. Where the solutions now are about the next generation. We're going to have tightness these years, no matter what they do.
How do you avoid those loopholes you talked about earlier? Because there are laws out there now that you have to fund them, especially if you're on the private side. Is there always going to be a way to get around it?
Well, I think you have, you know, an independent board, for instance, who vets, you know, is this, how are you calculating the numbers? There's a serious, I won't get into the details, but there's a serious debate now about whether any public systems have been properly calculating what proper funding is, because most public entities make more generous assumptions about how quickly their investments are going to grow than on the private side. At least in the private side, there's a Wall Street check, because analysts can say, you know, hey, look at these obligations. They're not putting enough in, and drive the stock down if they think the company's underfunded. There really needs to be a babysitter, an unconflicted public servant,
mm-hmm.
Of these funds, separate from the political process, because, you know, politicians' interest is not in putting money in. That has to be taxed. Their interest is in deferring it. On the private side, it gets tougher. One problem with 401ks, if since they're becoming, for like it or not, the system that more of us, and ultimately perhaps, you know, most of us, or all of us, are going to rely on in the private sector. One problem is that even people with 401ks are not putting enough money into them, and many people don't put any money into them, even though the companies would match it if they did.
Yeah.
So Obama has a pretty interesting idea, which is, right now, if you're in a 401k plan, you have to check a box that says, yeah, I'll contribute 3% or something. The company will match. If you don't check the box, they don't do anything. Believe it or not, a lot of people don't check the box. They get the forms. They put them on top of the TV. They never other paper builds up on it. You know what that happens. So the Obama idea is, by law, the default system has to be you contribute 3%. Now, you can always check a box and say, I won out. But if you don't do anything, if you're a procrastinator or whatever, then you automatically start to contribute.
Mm-hmm.
And that simple behavioral switch, economists think, would prompt more people to save. And another idea—
Would that hold up constitutionally government-mandated saving?
Well, you know, if you have the option, is there a legal difference between telling somebody, if you check the box, you save, otherwise not?
Uh-huh. So you still do have the option.
You know, you still have the option to opt out. But the company would be a little bit of in loco parentis and say, look, we think it's better for you to save. You're going to have to tell us that you don't want to.
Mm-hmm.
And, in fact, the government would be in loco parentis, because they'd be telling companies, we want you to do this for your workers.
Mm-hmm.
It's a little pushy, but would the result be better? That's one idea.
Yeah.
Another idea is for people at the bottom half of the income ladder to have a government match, a government pension, but really a 401k. Obama's idea was $500 per person per year. Hillary Clinton's was $1,000. And so that these people who are the people at the lower end, the people filling out that $31,000 median 401k plan, would begin, you know, if the government puts in $500 each year, you put in $500, you get in the habit, you start to put a little more in, you can see how people over 20 years, you know, then they'd have 60, 80, 100 instead of 30,000. You start to get something that looks like a retirement kitty.
Mm-hmm.
Now you have to pay for it. One advantage of the 401k of that government match is you got to do it with real money each year, so it doesn't become an unfunded obligation like the Social Security deficit and the Medicare deficit are. And, you know, that's another solution. Another idea another problem with 401ks is people spend through them. Yeah, you can spend the whole thing the first year. The beauty of a pension is, you know, you get a certain amount every year.
Yeah.
People should have people who have 401ks should be putting that money into an annuity. They're basically do-it-yourself pensions. And the government could encourage or, through the tax code, incentivize companies to make that the first option for people so that, in effect, you know, you're retired 58 and you have a little meeting with the human benefits counselor and he says, you know, this is how much you've got. And unless you do something, the company automatically puts in an annuity so that money stretches out for you and you get a stipend each year instead of putting it all in that condo in Florida. Well, we know what happened to the condo in Florida.
That's right. We're speaking with Roger Lowenstein on Open Line on WOSU. He is the author of the book While America Aged, How Pension Debts Are Looming as Our Next Financial Crisis. Roger, one of the problems, if we can use the word problem, is that we're living longer. And when we live longer, our pension needs and our retirement, you know, monetary needs extend out further. And also, our health care needs get more serious and get more expensive. And one of the things you've advocated is universal health care. And also, Walter Reuther from the UAW
That's also right. Advocated that.
I
think, you know, the days when health care is provided by the employer make, you know, they don't make really any more sense than, to use that other example, public schooling from your employer. And that doesn't mean that I don't think that we should socialize it. I still believe in private sector providers, hospitals, doctors, and so on. But the government should give you a voucher, probably a bigger voucher to people who earn less and a smaller voucher to people who earn more. And you can go spend it in the marketplace, and there's still incentives and everything. But you know, Starbucks now is spending more on the health care than it is on coffee beans. It's not just old line companies like GM. And this is a tremendous burden, as you say, coming from the blessing that we're living longer. There's some other interesting solutions or partial solutions to this. When you think about people living longer, does it make sense that we're retiring younger in the public sector, where I spend a lot of the book on? People retire at 50 or 55.
You know, yeah, you mentioned that, the New York City transit system, 55 years old, they were done.
Yeah, and cops at 50. So to go to transit, where a lot of the book's about, there was a strike over pensions, does it make sense to be spending as much time in retirement and collecting, including Social Security, as much in retirement as you were in the job? You know, we used to think of retirement as a sinecure at the end of life. Now it's half your career.
Mm-hmm.
That becomes unsustainable.
You even write it's your second long, lucrative career.
Yeah, and even in the public, private sector, I think we're going to see a trend towards older people working more, not steel workers,
mm-hmm.
you know, not jobs that are physically taxing to that degree, but society's going to need workers,
mm-hmm.
and older people are going to need income, and I think that's one way.
Presidential candidates, for one, they can work. They can.
Well, it seems like presidential candidates are now working in their 70s, doesn't
right.
it? We'll see if presidents are working in their 70s, but that's a way of attacking the problem. And one other interesting fix on this, or take on this, which is when people talk about the immigration issue, I think they lose sight of the fact that immigrants are really a demographic blessing. They're younger than most Americans. They have more kids than most Americans. They do great things for the Social Security system because they contribute, and the ones who are legal don't even collect benefits. The reason why America's demographic problem is not as severe as Europe's is because we're taking in more immigrants. So, you know, to the extent that we can keep our society younger or keep older people working more, these are ways of addressing the problem. There's not any one single bullet. There's an interesting part in the book. I think Lee Iacocca was one of the first executives in the auto industry to come to grips with the problem. And there's a funny scene. He takes a look at what Chrysler's spending on pensions and on health care, and comes across a line item for what they're spending on podiatrists, just podiatrists alone. And he just says, you know, he can't believe it. He says, we must have the healthiest feet in the country. And they have a board meeting to try and address the problem. And Iacocca, they're kicking it around. And one of the board members at Chrysler is Doug Fraser, who's head of the UAW, head of the union. And another is a former secretary of in the Lyndon B. Johnson administration. And he turns to these two board members and himself, and so motions in his arms in a circle, drawing them all in. He says, you know, we three of us really created this problem, meaning industry executives, labor unions, and government. And we're three are probably going to have to work our way out of it. And you know, I believe that. There's not one. It can't all come out of the hide of workers. It can't all come out of the hide of taxpayers or, you know, or shareholders.
Just a few minutes left with Roger Lowenstein, author of the book While America Aged, discusses our looming financial crisis of pension debts. Social Security, it's still there. You advocate raising the cap on income as a way to withholding tax.
Look, there's a Social Security deficit which is significant. It's not extreme. We could pay it off with a 2% increase in the payroll tax, which is now 12%, 12.6, I think. You know, bump it up to 14.5%. If you can, there's a problem though with how Social Security is funded, which is each generation pays for the generation that's older than it. Mm-hmm. So you get these demographic imbalances and these problems when one generation doesn't have as high a birth rate as the one before, which is what we have now. You know, I think I'd be in favor over time of raising enough money through the tax code so that we could put it on a current funding basis, so that each generation paid for itself, which is how a well-funded pension plan operates. If each generation pays for itself, it doesn't matter what happens to the birth rate, right?
Mm-hmm.
When you put the Social Security deficit together with a Medicare deficit, the problem becomes simply untenable. The federal government budget now is about a third going into these entitlements. In a generation, it'll be two-thirds, which means that, you know, either we cut out half of everything else we're spending, or the government simply broke. And none of the candidates has begun to address that program. And it's here and now. Social Security goes into a cash deficit in the administration of the next president. Medicare will be insolvent if nothing's done by 2019. And, you know, you heard of companies that are too big to fail. These are problems that are too big to touch. And neither Obama or McCain has addressed them.
Also, the government has been borrowing from the Social Security Fund during the good years.
The government has been living like the city of San Diego. It's been funding current revenues off of what has been a cash surplus from Social Security. This is the first year the baby boomers are retiring, and as more of them retire within a few years, that surplus disappears. Instead of being able to fund highway plans and defense and everything else from Social Security, it'll be the opposite. We'll be having to spend less on the highways and defense and school lunches and everything else to support Social Security, and that math will just get worse and worse for the next 25 years.
Just about 2 minutes left. Roger Lowenstein, what's a retirement plan going to look like 30, 40 years from now?
Wow, that is a great question. I think the government's going to be more involved, because I don't see any anyone else. You know, there's an irony to me when big institutions say, we can't handle the responsibility, and in effect foist it off on some guy who's spent 20 years or 30 years on an assembly line.
Mm-hmm.
If no institution can handle it, I think the federal government, we've seen what happened in housing when corporations can't handle the debts and individuals can't handle their mortgages. We've built up these liabilities. I don't think the age of big government is gone quite yet. I don't see anyone else, and I don't think we can or should let old people starve in the streets. So that would be my guess.
Okay. Roger Lowenstein, he's the author of the book While America Aged. It really is. It's a very complicated subject, but he writes it in a way that makes it easy to understand exactly what is going on here. Thank you very much, Roger Lowenstein.
Mike, thank you. It was a pleasure.
Thanks for joining us. When we come back on Open Line, Open Forum, we can talk about the pension system, we can talk about streetcars, we can talk about Republican Attorney General candidates, gaffes by presidential candidates. You pick the topic, you set the agenda. When Open Line continues on listener-supported WOSU and WOSU HD 820 Columbus and streaming on the web at WOSU.org. WOSU 820, NPR News.
Support for WOSU comes from the Donald R. Glancy Endowed Fund, a legacy of commitment to great programming on WOSU Public Media.